to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs. Can the Minister confirm that she verbally abused the Secretary of her department, causing the Secretary to leave her office in tears?
Give a call to the Minister for Home Affairs and the Minister for Cyber Security.
Thank you so much, Speaker. I thank the Deputy Leader of the Opposition for her question. The Secretary of my department and I work together really closely, and boy, have we got a job to do, Speaker, because we are working together to reform a department that was left in an absolute mess by the Leader of the Opposition. And, Speaker, look at what we've achieved on this together over the past year that we've been working together, Speaker. A cybersecurity strategy for our country, which is leading the world. A migration strategy that is fixing the mess left by the Leader of the Opposition in that system that isn't working. A big focus on integrity, Speaker, that is addressing some of the issues that I've raised with the Parliament before. We are continuing to work together very constructively. Thank you.
Order. Order. Members on my left will cease interjecting so I can hear from the member for Boothby.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Treasurer. What does the recent economic data mean for the budget in May, and how will the budget help clean up the mess the government inherited?
Give the call to the Treasurer.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. Thanks to the member for Boothby for all of her hard work and for her great question. Earlier today, Mr. Speaker, we got news that monthly inflation was steady at 3.4%. This means that monthly inflation is at its lowest level in more than 2 years. It also means that monthly inflation is now almost half what we inherited when we came to office. 3.4 now, 6.1 when we came to office. Now, as I said earlier in the week, Mr. Speaker, the monthly inflation figure is a bit less reliable than the quarterly one. Monthly bounces around a bit. And in the quarterly data, we're making even more progress. We inherited 2.1%. It's now 0.6%, Mr. Speaker. Still higher than we would like, but the direction of travel when it comes to inflation is welcome. It's encouraging and it's clear. And we're especially encouraged in today's numbers, Mr. Speaker, by new analysis by the ABS, which I can share with the House. Rent over the last year, Mr. Speaker, was 7.6%, too high, but it would have been 9.2% without our budget. But the one I want those opposite to particularly focus on, Mr. Speaker, is when you look at the electricity price rises since June of last year, they have gone up 3%. You know what they would have been were it not for our energy plan? 18.1%.
Order.
3%? 18.1% since the middle of last year.
Order.
When they
members
voted no
left,
to our energy
the
rebates,
Deakin,
they voted yes
to
even higher
New
inflation. Mr. Speaker, that's not an opinion. That is a fact. It means that our cost of living relief is working as we designed it to, and we see it in the figures. We're getting inflation down as an important part of ensuring that people are earning more and keeping more of what they earn. Now, we've got inflation moderating. We've got wages growing. That means we've turned real wages around. We inherited negative 3.4%, and they are now growing again. So real wages are growing, inflation is moderating, and unemployment is falling in the most recent data, Mr. Speaker. But we do acknowledge we've also got a slowing economy. We've also got global uncertainty, and people are still under pressure. And these are the three most important pressures and influences on the budget that we'll hand down from this dispatch box in May when the parliament next sits, Mr. Speaker. We will find the best balance of relief, repair and reform. Cost of living relief built on a tax cut for every single taxpayer. Repair of the budget and reform of our economy so that we can attract and deploy investment in ways that deliver a new generation of growth and productivity and competitiveness, so that we can get the budget in better nick without neglecting the pressures that we know people are still under, despite the welcome and encouraging news on inflation today.
We call to the Honourable the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs. Has the Minister apologised to the Secretary of her department following her verbal altercation?
Call to the Minister for Home Affairs and the Minister for Cybersecurity.
Thanks, Speaker. And it looks like I'm going to get a bit of time on my feet today, which I'm very excited about. If I could just briefly, on indulgence, acknowledge that we've got Greek leaders from around Australia here with us, and I want to welcome them to our parliament. It is a privilege to have you here. when the Greeks invented democracy, I'm not sure if this is exactly what they had in mind, but we're doing our absolute best.
Order.
Now, Speaker, as I've said to the response to the previous question, I work very closely with the Secretary of my department. And let me talk about some of the work that we are doing so constructively together, Speaker, because as I have spoken to the Parliament about before, we have a Home Affairs Department with some very, very significant issues.
The Minister will pause. I want to hear from the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
On relevance, Mr Speaker, point of order on relevance. It was a very direct question. Has the Minister apologised to the Secretary of her department?
The order. The Minister was asked a specific question. She's not entitled to then start talking about broad portfolio issues, so she'll order. She'll need just to keep her answer efficient to the question.
Absolutely, Speaker. And I'd say again to the Deputy Leader of the Opposition, my Secretary and I work very closely together. It's why I was very supportive of the decision of the Prime Minister and PM&C to appoint Secretary Foster to this role. We have an incredibly important clean-up job to do in the department work that we are doing. Speaker, don't take it from me. Take it from the litany of eminent Australians who have written reports about significant systemic issues in my department. Well, perhaps you should have waited before taking your point of order so quickly. Speaker, we have a significant job to do, but I'm committed to doing it because I'm here to serve the national interest, the political interests of the Liberal Party.
The Minister will resume her seat. Order. When the House comes to order, the Minister for the Environment. I'd like to hear from the member for Holt.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. How is the Albanese Labor government getting the NDIS back on track, making the scheme sustainable for the future generations and helping ensure every dollar is going to participants who need it?
Give the call to the order. The Leader of the Opposition will cease interjecting. Order, order. Members on my left, the member for Barker won't interject before I call the minister. The Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme and the Minister for Government Services has the call.
Members of this House know that the National Disability Insurance Scheme is changing lives. It is perhaps one of the best achievements of our parliament in the 21st century. There's now 650,000 people receiving individual packages of support. There's now about 400,000 people who say that they earn their main income for working in the NDIS. And it is an achievement of all sides of politics. And it started by bipartisan consensus, and we intend to try and keep that. However, it is true that the scheme is moving off track. The experience recorded by participants is that it isn't always consistent. It's not always equitable and it's not always transparent. There are some unethical service providers, a minority, who are taking advantage of participants in the scheme.
Indeed,
it also faces the risk of becoming the only lifeboat in the ocean. And what I mean by that is that the NDIS is now viewed to try and solve all issues for all people with disability in Australia. As a result, it's been growing faster than projected. Now, since the election, we've been getting on with improving the scheme. We've created a fraud task force. We've put people with disability in leadership positions in the agency. And also, we've commenced a root and branch review, which concluded in December of last year. Also significantly, our national cabinet of the Prime Minister and Premiers agreed to achieve an 8% target growth in 3 years. Also, the national cabinet's agreed the one way that we improve the future of the scheme is to build services for Australians with disability outside the NDIS, and that we would introduce legislation in the first half. And I'm pleased to advise the House that today we have introduced the draft bill. This bill is the result of a year and a half of consultation, of talking to people about how the scheme can be best improved. And I acknowledge the interest of members of the House in the scheme, because I've received 782 individual matters from MPs about issues to do with the NDIS. The bill contains a series of initial measures, how we can have better planning, better assessment, better cost controls, and build supports outside the scheme. So the bill is important, but it is not a fait accompli, and we don't put it forward on the basis that we don't want to hear the voices of the opposition and people with disability in coming weeks. There will be anxiety amongst people with disability whenever you talk about changing the scheme. The scheme, for all its imperfections, is the best chance that many families have and people have of having a better life. So in adopting the process of change, I want to reassure participants on the scheme, people who work in the area and the broader Australian people, that we will work through these in a consultative, collaborative manner. But I also say that the option of doing nothing is not an option. We say to people with disability, we won't seek change in fear, but we shouldn't fear to change. This scheme's too important for future generations.
Before I call the member for Clark, I just have a number of acknowledgements to do. He will get the call. I'm pleased to inform the House today that in the gallery today are Ministers Rhys Whitby and David Michael from the Western Australian Parliament, Mrs Joan Pearce, the member for Lytton, and a delegation from Thailand participating in the Canberra Fellowship Program hosted by DFAT. And I too would like to welcome our friends from the Greek Australian community. Welcome to Question Time. I give the call to the honourable member for Clark.
Speaker, my question is to the Prime Minister. Prime Minister, why has your government twice prevented me from tabling these documents, which contain evidence of appalling misconduct by AFL executives and some team staff? Why are you trying to keep them secret? Or can I walk down and give them to you personally right now?
Order. Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks, Mr Speaker. I thank the member for Clark for his question. I note that walking around the chamber is disorderly, but I do note that the member for Clark has always had access to me, as other members of parliament do. I have not. There isn't a member of parliament here, including over there, up there or behind me, who has asked to see me or made a phone call who has not had a call returned. Not one. Not one. That's the way that I deal with parliamentarians. I deal with senators the same, with respect. In general, we have an approach that when documents are requested to be tabled, if people want that, the normal process would be to ask, as when I was a member of the opposition and wanted something to be tabled, if I was serious about getting it tabled, I would ask, show it to the person who was the person at the at the dispatch box and receive that. But I am aware that the member for Clark has made allegations. Those allegations, I'm not aware of whether they are correct or not. You know, I have a big job. My job is not to, on that job description, isn't the control of the Australian Football League. But if issues are raised, the sport Integrity Australia is aware of the issue and they have begun their assessment, and I'm sure that the member for Clark will forward any documentation to the appropriate body.
Call to the honourable member for Reid.
My question is to the Minister for Transport. How is the Albanese Labor government's new vehicle efficiency standard delivering for Australians where previous governments couldn't?
Order. Give the call to the Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government.
Thank you so much, Mr Speaker, and can I thank very much the member for Reid for that question. She is someone who wants her constituents to benefit from the fuel savings. Having more efficient cars, whether they be petrol, diesel, hybrid or electric, would be if they were in the Australian market. This morning, of course, I introduced the Albanese government's new vehicle efficiency standard legislation into the parliament. And after a quarter of a century of failed attempts, Australia will finally have a new vehicle efficiency standard, a standard that will deliver Australians more choice of new cars, will save Australians thousands at the bowser, will reduce our emissions, and a model where Australians will continue to be able to buy the utes and the SUVs that they love. The shadow spokesperson for transport let the cat out of the bag yesterday with her sole contribution to the public debate on this matter was to gloat about the fact that her government shut down manufacturing of the Australian car industry. Despite being in government for two separate periods this century, that is their only policy contribution to the automotive sector in this country. While the Liberals and Nationals are gloating over and over again about destroying local manufacturing jobs, the Albanese Labor government is delivering Australians greater choice of cleaner, cheaper to run cars. And I note the member for Bradfield is contributing. I understand he's disappointed he was not able to get an efficiency standard when he was in government. Well, this side is delivering it, and I look forward to you voting for it. I look forward to you voting for it, member for Bradfield. Order. Despite being in government, as I said, for two separate periods this century, those opposite failed to deliver on their own policy of an efficiency standard. Now, the Minister for Climate Change and I have undertaken significant consultation with the industry, with climate groups, in developing this standard, and we thank everyone who has engaged constructively with us through this process. I note those opposite are, of course, not amongst that group, having yesterday said that they'd vote against the legislation before it had even been tabled or before they had even seen it. Nothing new about that. I'd particularly like to acknowledge Toyota, Hyundai, Tesla, the Motor Trades Association, the Automobile Dealers Association, Electric Vehicle Councils, for their positive engagement, and all of the other manufacturers who engaged constructively with our officers. Australians, frankly, have been left behind as consumers, as the most advanced economies across the world benefit from more fuel-efficient cars and greater access to new low and zero net zero technology. Together with Russia, we have been one of the only advanced economies that did not regulate the efficiency of new vehicles. It's time we got on with it. It's time we provided greater choice to Australian consumers so that they can benefit from the fuel savings that a fuel efficiency standard brings to everyone.
The call to the Honourable Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs. Can the minister confirm that other departmental staff were present at the time of her verbal altercation with the secretary of her department?
The call to the Minister for Home Affairs and the Minister for Cyber Security.
Thank you, Speaker. And I think we can all see and agree that agility is not exactly their strong point here. This is the third variation of the exact same question.
Order.
And I'd say again to the Deputy Leader and I'd say again to the Parliament, I am incredibly proud to work with the Secretary of my department. We're doing really important things in Home Affairs and we have a very close and collaborative relationship.
Order. The member for Wright will cease interjecting. When the House comes to order, we'll hear from the member for Macquarie.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Why is the rollout of renewables and storage in this decade so important? What other energy policies have been proposed?
Call to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Well,
thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. I thank my honourable friend for her question and, of course, her very strong climate leadership in her electorate and here in Canberra. And she knows, the honourable member knows, as do experts and the Australian Energy Regulator and the Australian Energy Market Operator and so many others, that rolling out renewables and storage over this decade is critical, not just for reducing emissions in this vital decade, but because it's the cheapest form of energy available, therefore it puts downward pressure on bills, and it's important for jobs and job creation. And also, Mr. Speaker, it's very important for reliability. As coal-fired power stations get older, we need to replace them. It's very important for reliability. Now, as I said, that is why it's important that our 5.9 gigawatts of new renewable energy over the last year and record storage deployment has been rolled out. Now, the honourable member asked me about alternative approaches, and the alternative approach that's been proposed by those opposite is nuclear. Now, nuclear might have some other challenges in rolling out across the country. Now, the Leader of the Opposition has been saying recently that business needs to speak up, business needs to talk out. The Leader of the Opposition said, I think CEOs have a moral obligation to speak up about what's happening in the economy. Well, based on the previous answer, he believes that unless they disagree with him. And I might have some bad news for the Leader of the Opposition, because the chief executive of one of Australia's largest energy companies, AGL, was asked about nuclear recently. And he said, and I quote, the cost, build time and public opinion are all prohibitive on nuclear. And then we had one of the country's largest energy users, Tomago Smelter, in the Hunter, asked about nuclear. And Mr. Sevilraja of Rio Tinto said, as far as we can see, all validated and independent data that exists on cost today say that nuclear is very expensive source of energy, and I think in Australia, certainly we've got low-cost wind and solar, and we're going to run with that. So you've got one of the world's large, the country's largest energy suppliers and one of the country's largest energy users saying it takes too long. Now, Mr Speaker, that's before we even get to where they will go and the location. We've had those 12 brave souls say not in their electorate. And we've also seen a speculation there'll be a nuclear power station at Anglesey in Victoria. But the Leader of the Opposition's office cleaned that up on the Surf Coast Times on the weekend. I read it every weekend. And the Leader of the Opposition's office issued a statement which said, and I quote, "Attempts to suggest the Coalition has any sort of nuclear plan are irresponsible and incorrect." So there we go. Any sort of nuclear plan is irresponsible and incorrect. Maybe they got it right, because they've got a thought bubble, but they certainly don't have a plan.
Give a call to the honourable order. Members on my left, the member for New England is continuously interjecting. He's now warned, so no more interjections from the member for New England. Give the call to the Honourable the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs. On 12 February, the Department of Home Affairs told Senate estimates that 149 criminals, including 7 murderers, 37 sex offenders and 72 other violent criminals, had been released from immigration detention. 7 separate government sources have told the Sydney Morning Herald the Minister's office attempted to ensure the Department never gave this evidence so that the explosive document would be kept hidden from the Australian public. Minister, is this true?
Give a call to the Minister for Home Affairs and the Minister for Cybersecurity.
Well, thanks so much, Speaker. And I'd say to the Deputy Leader of the Opposition, I'm not sure what the complaint is here, because the government was requested information and the information was provided to the opposition and to the public.
Order. Just going to have the House come to order so I can hear from the member for Paterson.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. How do we build a future made in Australia? And what's been standing in the way of making more things here, PM?
Give a call to the Prime Minister.
I thank the member for Paterson for her question. I look forward to being back in the Hunter tomorrow with the member for Hunter and the member for Paterson and other members as well. Speaking about the importance in that great manufacturing centre of Australia of making things right here in Australia. Not just exporting our resources that give us a great deal of value here to our national economy and create jobs, but where we can, making sure that we value add, which is an issue for our economy, but it's also an issue of our national security. Because we need to be a resilient economy. We need to be one that isn't dependent and vulnerable to shocks, be it a pandemic or be it conflict internationally, which can have an impact on the Australian economy. And that's why there is such a stark contrast, because our government does believe in a future made in Australia, investing in solar and wind and new energy, investing in manufacturing and critical minerals, investing in people through fee-free TAFE and the plan that's been put forward by the Education Minister of the Universities Accord, creating jobs in our suburbs and creating jobs in our regions, building energy security, economic security and national security, moving up the international value chain. This is a whole-of-nation opportunity that we have, which requires a whole-of-economy approach. And that is my government's approach. And it does stand in contrast to the impediments which have been there. I was quite stunned that yesterday the Shadow Minister for Infrastructure and Transport sent out a tweet about EVs. She said this: "The changes being mooted by Labor's policy are the most significant changes to our auto and motoring industry since we shut down manufacturing."
Wow.
She put her hand up in a tweet.
Right.
But then, just in case it was an error, later she held a press conference and she said this: The changes being mooted by the Labor Party's policy are the most significant changes to our automobile industry, to our motoring industry, since we shut down manufacturing. But she went on. She said, that's a fact. It sure is. It sure is a fact. That is the coalition's...
Order. The Prime Minister's
Shadow Minister for Infrastructure and Transport.
Before I call the member for Wannon, he will get the call. Just order. I'm trying to acknowledge some guests in the gallery. Interjections are highly disorderly before I call the member for Wannon. I'd like to acknowledge Mr. Michael Galea, a member of the Victorian Parliament, and also Australian Indigenous Education Foundation scholars and CEO Andrew Penfold, who are joining us in the Southern Gallery, and representatives from the Isolated Parents Association of Australia. Give the call to the honourable member for Wannon.
Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Immigration. Minister, you weren't talking to the Secretary of your department when 149 former immigration detainees were roaming free and 39 asylum seekers arrived at Beagle Bay in Western Australia. Why should the Australian people have any confidence that you can keep them safe?
I'm just not sure if that was a statement or a question at the beginning part, but I'll just hear from the Leader of the House. There was a question at the end of the statement.
Mr Speaker, the member's been here long enough to know that if you're using the word you, it's a question directed at the Speaker, and it could at least be phrased in a way that's in order.
Yeah. I'll allow the... I know the member for one and always likes to follow the rules, so I'll allow him to phrase the question.
Would you like me to ask the whole thing again? Or just the question?
You can do the whole thing. I'm feeling generous today.
Okay.
It's Easter.
My question is to the Minister for Immigration. The Minister wasn't talking to the Secretary of his department when 149 former immigration detainees were roaming free and 39 asylum seekers arrived at Beagle Bay in Western Australia. Minister, why should the Australian people have any confidence that you, the Minister, can keep them safe?
Order. The Minister for Home Affairs will cease interjecting. Order. I want to hear from the Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs.
Thank you, Speaker, and I thank the member for Wannon for his question. But let me make one thing very clear. The allegation that it's based on is simply not true. It is simply not true. And I can say further Order. To that I speak with Ms Foster very regularly, as I did when she was the Associate Secretary. She is a highly credentialed public servant who I'm privileged to work with, together with my friend, the Minister for Home Affairs.
The call to the honourable member for Dunkley.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Communications. How is the Albanese Labor government's expansion of the national broadband network delivering productivity and cost of living benefits for Australians after a wasted decade?
Give a call to the Minister for Communications.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member for her question. Labor founded the National Broadband Network to provide fast, reliable and affordable broadband to all Australians, and we are delivering on our vision of a world-class fibre network. The Albanese government is investing $2.4 billion over 4 years to give more households and businesses full fibre access, and we are making swift progress. Upgrades are underway across the country, with NBN announcing this week that 2 million premises in New South Wales and Victoria can now order a full fibre upgrade. And I'm pleased to inform the member that there are some 43,000 premises in her electorate of Dunkley that can get a high-speed fibre connection. And the upgrades include 660,000 homes and businesses in the regions that are currently on slower, less reliable copper wire. Full fibre upgrades boost the reliability of services and the productivity of our homes and businesses, helping give back precious time in the day as well as cost savings. The upgrades support the fast-evolving ways in which Australians work, study and interact. For instance, the average home now hosts some 21 internet-connected or smart devices, and data usage in Australia has increased 10 times over the past 10 years. And that's why fibre is so important, because it can deliver speeds 18 times faster than the average copper connection, has less latency and is less likely to drop out. The productivity and efficiency gains are so significant. Research commissioned by NBN Co shows Australians can save more than 100 hours and $2,580 per year in avoided travel time and costs in working from home and undertaking tasks online. But Mr Speaker, this was lost on those opposite, because during their wasted decade, their oversight of the NBN was a masterclass in economic and technical incompetence. Who could forget Tony Abbott's famous forecast that, and I quote, "We are absolutely confident that 25 megs is going to be enough, more than enough, for the average household," he said. Mr Speaker, it is only a Labor government that can be relied on to invest in the long-term infrastructure that Australia needs to help with cost of living, improve our national productivity and support our businesses to be globally competitive. And it's great to see NBN Co is now consulting with industry on a plan to turbocharge speeds to give customers who upgrade to faster speeds at no extra wholesale costs, meaning people would get more for what they pay on their telco bills. Only Labor can be relied on to provide meaningful help with cost of living.
Call to the Leader of the Australian Greens.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Resources Minister. A few months after being appointed Resources Minister, the Minister said on ABC Perth Radio that carbon dioxide was not noxious and, quote, "It's the bubbles in your soda water or out of your soda stream, so, you know, we've got to keep it in balance how we think about carbon dioxide." Is this reckless, dangerous view the reason the Minister is so intent on opening up massive new climate-destroying gas projects, even if it derails the rest of the government's legislative agenda?
Order. Order. Members on my right, members on my left will cease interjecting. Order. Order. Members on my right, the member for Spence. Order. The Minister for Resources and the Minister for Northern Australia has the call.
No, it's
Member
science.
Patterson is warned.
Carbon dioxide in low amounts, which is in SodaStream and is in soft drinks, it's very popular, isn't noxious. Like, it absolutely is not. Of course, dangerous amounts of carbon dioxide through our climate is, of course, dangerous. I'm not a climate denier. There are people in this building that might be, and I don't think there are fewer and fewer every year. So it is not noxious in the small amounts to which I referred to in that interview. Dangerous amounts of carbon dioxide causes global warming, and that is why this government has taken steps immediately upon becoming elected to introduce measures. We've passed many bits of legislation, the safeguards mechanism, the climate targets, the vehicle Order. Emission standard scheme that is going Order. Through the parliament right now. And I would remind the Leader for the Greens, the Greens political party, Order. Exactly what his Linda's party has left. Done in the past. It is the party of the Greens political party that came into this parliament and voted against the CPRS many years ago. Oh, yeah, you might laugh, member for Melbourne. Oh, don't, you should go right ahead through you, Mr. Order. Speaker. But the thing is, the record is here on Hansard. History has been set, and you helped set it and put back this country's battle to fight climate change back decades. So I say to the Leader of the Greens political party, you get exactly what you deserve. Your party has made this happen all on your very own for your very own political purposes. Mr. Speaker, I must object to the member for Melbourne continuing to laugh at what is a very serious topic. This government is taking action from the moment we got elected as a party of government, not a party of protest like the Greens political party, to take action to address dangerous climate change. And the Leader of the Greens political party comes in here and has a little chit-chat
about SodaStream and bubbles that might be in Coca-Cola and other soft drinks as if it's the same thing as dangerous climate change caused by carbon dioxide. Through you, Mr Speaker, the Greens political party and its leader has gone too far. You're ridiculous and you should just stop it.
Order. Order. I remind all members. Order. Order. Members on my right will cease and ejecting. Order. No, order. The House is going to come to order so I can hear the next question. That sort of behaviour is completely unacceptable. Order. Every member is entitled to ask a question of their choice, and they should be respected in their right to do so. The House comes to order. I'll hear from the member for Pearce.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Deputy Prime Minister. How is the Albanese Labor government investing in defence to keep all Australians safe? What does this mean for South Australia and Western Australia in particular? And what other approaches have been rejected?
Give a call to the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Defence.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. The Sovereign Submarine Partnership, which was announced last Friday with the US and the UK, will transform industry in South Australia and in the member's own home state of Western Australia.
The Defence Minister will pause. We are 10 seconds into an answer. The member for Casey has been interjecting all week. He's going to leave the chamber under 94A. This is completely unacceptable when a minister has just begun within seconds to start yelling. It's highly disorderly and highly disrespectful. The Deputy Prime Minister has the call.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. At the Osborne Naval Shipyard in Adelaide, at full production, there will be 4,000 to 5,000 people building our future submarines. And in combination with those building our future frigates, the Osborne Naval Shipyard will be home to 7,000 highly skilled workers. And to enable this, the government is investing in a skills academy which will be situated at Osborne and modelled very much on the training academy of BAE at its facility at Barrow in Furness. And in Western Australia, ASC is standing up a workforce of 500 people to sustain submarines as part of the Submarine Rotational Force West. And that is happening right now. There are employees of ASC on their way to Hawaii to gain valuable experience. Indeed, by next year, we will see a target of 100 employees of ASC working and gaining experience at Pearl Harbor. And that's in addition to the 1,200 people that will be needed at the future Henderson Naval Precinct to build Navy's future platforms, including our general purpose frigate. And to see that happen, we're working closely with South Metro TAFE in Perth to build the necessary skills. This is a future made in Australia to secure Australia, high-skilled, high-wage jobs. But to do this requires resources, which is why the government is increasing defence spending to 2.4% of GDP. Now, those opposite have been repeatedly asked about defence spending, and they have stubbornly refused to answer that question, which leaves them where they were at the last election, which is a spend of 2.1% of GDP over the same period. But, Mr Speaker, the issue is that 2.1% will not build our frigates. 2.1% will not manufacture long-range missiles. 2.1% will not deliver us an amphibious army. 2.1% will not give us AUKUS. Those opposite stand for cuts to defence spending. And with it, they stand for cuts to jobs in South Australia, in Western Australia, in the shadow ministers' own electorate. But much worse than that, those opposite now stand for compromising Australia's national security. Well, the Albanese government is committed to increasing defence spending to deliver our future submarines to keep Australians safe.
give a call to the Honourable the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs, and I refer to media reports about interactions between the Secretary of the Department and the ministers she serves. The Minister for Immigration was asked about these reports and gave a clear denial. I ask the Minister again, did she verbally abuse the Secretary, causing the Secretary to leave her office in tears?
I call to the Minister for Home Affairs and the Minister for Cybersecurity.
Speaker, this question has been asked in a number of different ways. I've answered it in a number of ways, all of which have been accurate. And I'd say to the Deputy Leader of the Opposition, I enjoy a very close and warm relationship with the Secretary of my department. She is a public servant of decades of standing, serving the national interest in our government. It's why I supported the Prime Minister's decision to appoint her to this position, and we continue that warm and collaborative relationship.
Order. Give a call to the Honourable Member for Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Health. How is the Albanese Labor government making it easier for all Australians to access affordable health care after a decade of cuts and neglect?
Call to the Minister for Health and Aged Care.
Well, thank you, Speaker, and I thank the Member for Hunter for his question and for all his hard work delivering cheaper, better health care in the Hunter Valley. Things like establishing the Cessnock Urgent Care Clinic and resurrecting the terrific GP access after-hours service in that area. Mr. Speaker, as the party that introduced the PBS, Medibank and then Medicare, Labor has no higher priority than ensuring every single Australian is able to access high-quality, affordable health care, no matter where they live, no matter what their income. And as the member says, that mission is especially critical after the decade of cuts and neglect we witnessed under those opposite. We came to government, Mr. Speaker, promising to strengthen Medicare and deliver cheaper medicines. And the Treasurer's responsible budget management not only delivered the first surplus in 15 years, it also made room for landmark investments to deliver on that promise, a position that could not be more different from the position of the former government that didn't manage a single surplus in their decade of office and had a record of shocking cuts to Medicare, initiated, of course, by the Leader of the Opposition when he was the Health Minister. Because, Mr. Speaker, Australians will never forget that the Leader of the Opposition, as Health Minister, in his first budget, tried to abolish bulk billing altogether and make every single Australian pay a fee every single time they went to the doctor. And when he couldn't get that through the parliament, Mr. Speaker, he froze the Medicare rebate for 6 long years, ripping billions of dollars out of Medicare. Our first budget contained the biggest ever investment in bulk billing in history, tripling the bulk billing incentive, an investment which, just in the first 2 months, delivered an additional 2,500 free visits to the doctor in the member for Hunter's electorate alone. The Leader of the Opposition's first budget also, as Health Minister, tried to jack up the price of medicines by up to $5 a script, the centrepiece of his dearer medicines policy. In under just 2 years, we've managed to lower the annual medicine bills for millions of pensioners, the biggest cut to the price of medicines in the 75-year history of the PBS, and 60-day scripts for common medicines, saving patients time as well as even more money, Mr. Speaker. And of course, no one will forget the Leader of the Opposition, as Health Minister, tried to rip $50 billion out of our public hospitals. $50 billion. While this Prime Minister, by contrast, agreed a landmark new funding arrangement with premiers and chief ministers in December that will deliver an additional $14 billion in extra funds over the next 5 years for our important public hospitals. Stronger medicines, cheaper medicines. That's what you get under this government, Mr. Speaker. All we got under the Leader of the Opposition was cuts and chaos.
The call to the Honourable Member for Mayo.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Health and Aged Care. Minister, my constituents tell me that there is a 700-patient wait list for the shingles vaccine at just one GP clinic on the Mayo South Coast, and it's reported that that clinic is limited to receiving just 15 vaccines at a time. As Minister, what urgent steps are you taking to ensure that older and vulnerable Australians who need this vaccine are able to gain access in a timely manner?
Call to the Minister for Health and Aged Care.
Thank you, Speaker. And I thank the member for Mayo for her question, her interest in healthcare, and drawing attention again to the House to the very significant investment that we've made in listing the Shingrix vaccine very, very quickly after the first recommendation was made by the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee late last year. This is really a life-changing vaccine, particularly for older Australians. It's not often well understood enough just how debilitating a case of shingles can be, particularly for older Australians, but also for younger Australians who may be immunocompromised. The supply arrangements that we came to with the company with the new Shingrix vaccine late last year was modelled on the usual basis that we model these things, with ABS data and an analysis of likely uptake. And we have, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head for the member for Mayo, but we ordered literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of doses, recognising that there would be a very significant interest among older Australians to access this vaccine. Now, I've been engaging very closely, not just with my department, but also with state and territory authorities who have, state governments have responsibility for distributing vaccines under the National Immunisation Program to access points, which are essentially general practices and pharmacies. We've been working very closely with them, including in South Australia, where there's probably been more public attention around this question than in other jurisdictions. I haven't had advice for a few weeks, but the latest advice I got was that supply constraints or supply issues were being resolved in all jurisdictions. We've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of additional doses that are coming into Australia over the course of the first half of this year. Many of them landed in February. I haven't had an update to suggest that there are additional supply issues for some weeks. I'm concerned that the member for Mayo has raised that. I'd be very interested in having a discussion with her offline, because I'm absolutely determined to make sure that as many Australians as possible get access to this life-changing vaccine.
Give a call to Member for Tangney.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Education. Why do we need to build a better and fairer education system? And what is standing in the way of that? Thank you.
Give a call to the Minister for Education.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker, and can I thank my friend, the terrific member for Tangney, for his question. Mr. Speaker, we want Australians to earn more and keep more of what they earn. And that means pay rises and tax cuts. Pay rises and tax cuts. And for a brand new teacher in New South Wales at the moment, they're now on $85,000 a year, the highest paid teachers in the country. And from the 1st of July, they'll get a tax cut of more than $1,800. That's good news, because our teachers do an important job, the most important job in the country. And that job has got a lot tougher in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, we've seen teacher shortages go up. And over the last 10 years, we've also seen the number of kids finishing high school go down. Not everywhere, but in our public schools, we've seen a drop from 83% down to 76%. And, Mr. Speaker, it's no surprise that this has all happened after the Liberal Party ripped the guts out of Gonski funding. We've got a big anniversary coming up, because in 7 weeks' time it'll be 10 years since the Liberal Party ripped more than $20 billion out of public schools in this country. Remember that cigar-chomping budget? And guess who was on ERC at the time? Old Smiley over there, the opposition leader. You know, the health minister talked about.
Order. The member for Moreton is warned. The treasurer will cease interjecting, and he is warned as well. People cannot interject when someone is taking a point of order. I don't know how many times I have to tell that. Every member is entitled to take a point of order, including and especially the manager of opposition business, and he has the call.
Mr. Speaker, there are standing orders about the respectful way in which parliamentarians are supposed to speak about each other, and this minister has breached that.
Order. Order. Members on my right. Order. This is an issue that I'm very exercised about too. The Leader of the House.
Mr Speaker, this would be the first time ever someone's taken offence to being accused of smiling.
Look, I'm not going to... Order. I'll deal with it. All right, I'll hear from the manager. Order. Members on my right. The manager is right to raise a point of order.
As the Leader of the House would be well aware, Standing Order 90, amongst other things, all imputations of improper motives to a member or personal reflections on other members should be considered highly disorderly, as well as a range of other standing orders.
Order. We don't need sound effects from those on my right. Member for Swan and the member for Reid can stop interjecting immediately. I'm just going to ask, the minister doesn't have to withdraw anything, but I'm just going to ask him to temper his language and make sure he's showing respect to all members of parliament, and that's to both sides of the house. Everyone has titles, everyone's earned titles to be here. Just asking everyone to show each other respect. The Minister for Education has the call.
Now that's a breach of the standing orders, I suspect.
The order. Well, you know, order. I just asked everyone to show each other respect. Yeah. So we're going to put away phones. We're going to put away comments and just get back to question time.
I'm just trying to turn that frown upside down, Mr. Speaker. Mr Speaker, they didn't just rip the guts out of hospitals, they ripped the guts out of schools as well, and we're all paying the price for that now. That's why what we announced in the Northern Territory a couple of weeks ago is so important. The biggest single investment in public education by the Australian government in the Northern Territory ever. Bringing forward the day when we fully fund public schools in the Northern Territory by more than 20 years. And that's not a blank cheque. That funding will be tied to the sort of things that are going to help more kids finish high school. And that'll change the lives of kids in the Northern Territory. Because if they finish school, their kids, when they have them, will be more likely to finish school too. That's what a good education does. It ricochets through families and communities. It ricochets through generations. And it helps all of us here too. Because it means we'll have a stronger economy if more kids finish school, and a better and a fairer country. But to do this, we'll need to introduce legislation through this parliament to increase the investment in public education. And London to a brick, when we do this, the Liberal Party will vote against it. And if they win the next election, then you know exactly what they'll do, what they did 10 years ago. Light up the cigars, rip the money out of public schools, and smile while they do it.
Call to the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs. In 2018, the now Minister said that the culture in Parliament, quote, feels really toxic for normal people generally, but in particular for women. So there's a level of aggression, of conflict, of egocentrism that dominates the culture in Parliament House, and I think it's quite hard to handle, end quote. How is this consistent with the minister's verbal abuse of her secretary, causing her to leave her office in tears?
Order. The Minister for Home Affairs and Minister for Cybersecurity has the call.
And I thank the Deputy Leader of the Opposition for her question. I don't know how many times I'm going to have to repeat this to her. I have an incredibly warm and collaborative relationship with the Secretary of my department. We are doing very important work together, cleaning up the catastrophic mess left in Home Affairs by the Leader of the Opposition. We work on it together and we're proud of the work we do together.
Order. Give the call to the Chief Government Whip.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Aged Care. What is the Albanese Labor Government doing to ensure dedicated and hard-working aged care workers can earn more and keep more of what they earn after a decade of neglect?
Yep. Call to the Minister for Aged Care and the Minister for Sport.
I thank the wonderful member for Lawler for her question.
The Albanese government knows that strong, sustainable wage growth is part of the solution to the cost of living crisis. It is not part of the problem. And that's why we believe that workers deserve to earn more and to keep more of what they earn. And that's why, unlike the opposition, we backed aged care workers in their fight for better wages at the Fair Work Commission. And unlike the opposition, we delivered. We delivered a 15% increase to award wage minimums for 250,000 workers across this country. An $11.3 billion commitment. Under the Albanese government, registered nurses are now taking home an additional $196 per week, or $10,000 per year. Personal care workers are now taking home an additional $141 per week, or $7,300 every single year. And that pay rise is changing lives around the country. Mr. Speaker, today I met Jocelyn, Sue, Donna and Michelle. These four women have between them 103 years' experience working in aged care in Australia. They are, of their own volition, guardians. And they are the stewards of change in aged care. Before the Royal Commission, Mr. Speaker, I'm sad to say that they were canaries in the coal mine. They marched through this place, they begged for help, and when the Coalition were in power, their pleas fell on deaf ears. Jocelyn sung and danced in the halls of Parliament House the day the now Prime Minister delivered his budget reply speech promising to back a pay rise for aged care workers. And Sue was with the Prime Minister and I at Hammond Care Miranda after we funded that pay rise. And today, these women told me that for the very first time, a lot of their colleagues have now become the breadwinners in their household. Some of them are now earning more money than their teenagers. Can you believe that until this point, that was not the case? But we know that still cost of living is biting for people like Sue, like Jocelyn, like Donna and Michelle. And that's why from 1 July the Albanese government will deliver a tax cut for every single Australian taxpayer so that every taxpayer, including our aged care workers, can earn more and keep more of what they earn. 97% of aged care workers, who are overwhelmingly women, will be better off under Labor's tax cuts. So not only can a registered nurse working in an aged care home take home $10,000 more under the Albanese government, they'll also get a tax cut of $1,679 from 1 July, almost double what they would have got under the Coalition. And with my final moments, can I congratulate the GOAT, Lauren Jackson, on her selection to the Olympic qualifying squad for Paris.
Call to the Honourable the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Home Affairs. Can the minister now confirm that she verbally abused the secretary of her department, causing the secretary to leave her office in tears?
Call to the Minister for Home Affairs and the Minister for Cybersecurity.
Yeah, and I'd say again to the Deputy Leader, with respect, she has now asked me the same question about five times, and I'm going to give you the same answer. And the answer is that Secretary Foster and I enjoy a very warm and collaborative relationship. We have an enormous job to deal with because we are together managing a department which was left in a catastrophic mess by the Leader of the Opposition. Cybersecurity, immigration, parts of national security that needed a big clean-up effort. We're working on it together. We do that in a warm and
collaborative. Concluded her answer. Give the call to the Honourable Member for Higgins.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Why is the government rejecting nuclear energy for Australia? Could the Prime Minister compare and contrast the government's reasons for this decision?
Give a call to the Prime Minister.
Thanks very much. And I thank the Member for Higgins for her question. My favourite ever Member for Higgins, I must say. And the Member for Higgins understands that climate change is not just a challenge, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to create jobs and to grow the economy. And indeed, a survey of institutional investors with $37 trillion in assets under management found this. So we're asked what their top five responses were to deliver the best long-term returns for their beneficiaries. Number one, renewable energy. 47%. Second, biodiversity, third, energy storage, fourth, low-carbon transport, and fifth, industry materials, including critical minerals. Nuclear energy was last, Mr. Speaker, last. And perhaps the Leader of the Opposition has identified why. Because he said that everything will all be fine in soothing the nerves of his members behind him there. There are only four outstanding issues: safety, disposal, cost and location. Apart from that, it's full steam ahead.
Member for Deakin.
Full steam ahead. It's no wonder no one wants to campaign with him on these issues, Mr. Speaker, because no one believes that absence makes the heart grow fonder, quite like the Leader of the Opposition. There were no public appearances in Tasmania for 55 days before last week's election. 55 days. There were no public appearances in Victoria for 37 days before the last state election.
Order. The member for Deakin will
But that's
Deakin.
Nothing like New South Wales, Mr. Speaker, where there were no public appearances in New South Wales for 142 Order. Days before the election. Almost half a year. Seems to suit everyone. I'll give you a big tip, though. It's a lot harder to hide a nuclear reactor. And you've said that they're going to be right around the country. Right around the country.
Order,
ask your coalition MP, what would you rather have in your backyard, the Leader of the Opposition or a nuclear reactor? And they reply, we'll get back to you. One is risky, expensive, divisive and toxic. The other is a nuclear reactor. Mr. Speaker.
Order.
The bad news for the Liberal Party is that you can put both on a core flute, and we certainly intend to do so.
Order them. When the House comes to order. Order. The member for Hume and the Treasurer will cease objecting. I just want to call the Leader of the Opposition, so the sooner you stop speaking, the sooner I can call him. The Leader of the Opposition has the call.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Since being elected, the Prime Minister has spent just 4 hours in Alice Springs. At the moment, local residents, business owners, school principals and the Mayor have all been pleading for support from you, Prime Minister. Yet locals have seen little evidence of the $250 million package that you promised making any difference to improve community safety. In fact, the situation has got much worse. Children are committing serious crimes, sexual abuse is at a record high, juvenile crime and domestic crime and abuse is at a record high. When does the Prime Minister intend to visit Alice Springs?
Order. Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. I have visited Northern Territory, including Alice Springs, more than the three previous Liberal Prime Ministers combined. In 2 years.
The Prime Minister will pause. The Leader of the Opposition has asked his question. He was heard in silence. Members on my left, we're just going to hear the Prime Minister. It's a serious question. We're going to listen to the answer. Order. The Prime Minister has the call.
And just last week, Mr. Speaker, I took the entire Cabinet to the Northern Territory, and we had ministers in Alice Springs, in Katherine, in remote Northern Territory as well. And I visited a remote community to commit to $4 billion, $4 billion to fix housing in remote communities, something that was never done by those opposite who, when they were in government, in the 2014 budget, ripped money out of. Just like in their last budget, in 2022, they left funding going off a cliff, including in Alice Springs for community organisations, for organisations that look after women's safety, for organisations that look after children. All of the funding stopped on June 30 of that year. And we had to engage and find money, including $250 million, which we have done with our Better, Safer Future for Central Australia plan. We are delivering.
The Prime Minister will put the Leader of the Opposition will withdraw that comment. So we can continue on.
I withdraw.
The Prime Minister in continuation.
A bloke who barely leaves his office, doesn't get out and about,
The member for La Trobe.
Except for his Wednesday night appearance on Sky News.
Order. The Prime Minister will pause. The Leader of the Opposition, a point of order.
Well, Mr Speaker, it's on relevance. I know the Prime Minister's got a glass jaw. He was there for 4 hours.
Resume your seat. Order. The Leader of the Opposition knows that's an abuse of process. I've been very lenient with taking points of order on relevance and explaining my process of dealing with relevance. That sort of interjection is highly disorderly and highly disrespectful. I'm warning the Leader of the Opposition. So I just want some silence for the remainder of this question. Prime Minister has the call.
Mr Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition shows his weakness with his incapacity to stand up on any difficult issue to his backbench, any whatsoever. And we saw it again today. A group whose lesson they took from the last election was that they weren't right-wing enough and they weren't conservative enough and they weren't reactionary enough. A group that have gone from being reactionaries to being nuclear reactionaries with the one policy that they've come out with, but then they won't come out with any detail. As I said, I have been a regular visitor to the Northern Territory. I will continue to be a regular visitor to the Northern Territory, just as I suspect this bloke will be a continual regular visitor to Gina Rinehart's parties.
Order. Give the order. The Deputy Leader of the Opposition is not helping the House come into order. I'm going to hear from the member for Werriwa.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. How are the Albanese Labor Government's reforms to enterprise bargaining helping Australians to earn more and keep more of what they earn? How accurate have predictions about the policy been?
The call to the Minister for Employment, Workplace Relations and the Minister for the Arts.
Thanks very much, Speaker. And I want to thank the member for the question. A tireless worker in southwestern Sydney and a defender of making sure that people earn more and keep more of what they earn. There was a debate in the first year of this term in the Secure Jobs Better Pay Bill about multi-employer bargaining, and different predictions were made. We said that it would improve wages, that it would improve conditions, that it would improve job security and it would improve productivity. But those opposite made predictions as well about multi-employer bargaining. They said modestly it would close down Australia, it would burn down Australia, it would result in coast-to-coast strikes and it would smash productivity. Well, we now have the first of the multi-employer bargains being reported by Ewan Hannon in The Australian today in the air conditioning manufacturing industry. And what we find there is the following. 6% pay rises each year for 4 years for those workers. Job security and casual conversion, and productivity improvements, including skills development, span of working hours, and better apprentice pay rates. The full-time pay rate will go from $102,000 to $133,000 over the course of 4 years, and those same workers will get a tax cut of more than $2,200 now, and by the final year of the agreement, more than $3,500. It's worth having a listen comparing to what those opposites said multi-employer bargaining would result in, to what the employer organisation have said about this agreement that is only possible because we changed the law. From HVAC, the President, Mimmo Scavera, quote, some wins, some losses on both sides, and we came up with a happy medium we're all satisfied with. Quote, a better skilled workforce and an organised workforce is always a better productive workforce. Quote,
For us, it's a move to improve our industry, to make it a safer, more skilled industry. It's a big leap forward on both sides. Working together means it's going to improve productivity. There's no use doing it any other way. It doesn't work. Those opposite might be determined to send people into their corners in a world of conflict. With these new laws, we have brought parties together that had not previously been able to reach agreements. What happened in the past? You get one employer reach an agreement, and then a dodgy operator be able to come in and undercut the rates of pay, and there was a race to the bottom. What we have now is a race to best practice standards. What we have now is a race to improve job security. What we have now is the best employers don't get punished for being the best employers. Those opposite might be determined that people work longer for less, but the Albanese Labor government's making sure people earn more and keep more of what they earn.
I call the Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I ask that further questions be placed on the notice paper.